The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponsek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, the Federal Reserve held their last meeting of the year, keeping policy unchanged, and the ECB had their first with Christine Lagarde at the helm. Plus, after one of the best years for the bull market in stocks, what is there now to look forward to?
Well, one thing, Sarah, you can look forward to is the craziest thing I saw in markets this week, our tradition, which we will end the show with, of course. And a reminder, if you see something crazy in markets, see something, say something. Specifically, call our What Goes Up hotline and leave us a voicemail. Sarah, what's that number again?
That number is 646-324-3490. So as Mike said, if you see something, say something.
Yeah, and maybe we'll play your voicemail on the show. But let's get right to today's show. We've got a first-time guest on the show. His name is Mike Schumacher. He is the head of interest rate strategy at Wells Fargo. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Great. And another guest back literally by popular demand. If your listeners out there, I don't know if you realize this, you can request guests, apparently.
So this became a new trend in our Twitter feed. When we ask for crazy things, well, instead, we have just gotten demands for our other guests. So,
Thanks, Mom.
Yes. And this one goes out to you, Ellie Paname.
Oh, my
at
God.
@mon_singe on
sure.
Twitter, who tweeted at us, "We demand more Nagy. Give the people what they want." Well, we're giving it to you, Ellie Paname. I'm a little suspicious about this account, Chris.
Yep.
The profile picture is a picture of Kevin McHale of the Boston Celtics wearing shorts that I cannot describe on a family podcast due to that 80s era basketball shorts. Chris, being a Boston native, I'm a little skeptical about this, but we're going to assume this is a real grassroots campaign.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. There's nothing to no one I've ever met in my life.
Okay. Did you believe that, Sarah?
Not at all. And that voice is Chris Nagy, the executive editor of the Cross Asset Team and Equities here at Bloomberg.
And Mike, they're going to be tweeting to demand you, I'm sure, again.
Fantastic. I will not wear funny shorts, I promise that.
So Mike, I wanted to ask you, you know, we got some inflation data this week. I know the Fed prefers PCE, but the latest data we got was CPI. I got to say, core CPI 2.3%, headline was about 2.1%. At what point do we have to start worrying about the Fed when it comes to inflation? I mean, this isn't the highest it's been at the cycle, but you know, we're getting back to sort of that target level.
The Fed would like to see inflation tick up. Frankly, from Chairman Powell's discussion recently, he'd be thrilled if inflation were 2.2, 2.3 on a core basis for an extended period. Central bankers know what to do with inflation. They just hit it over the head. So the Fed could let inflation run for a while. That would be dandy. So bottom line is we're not concerned. I don't think the Fed is either.
So inflation was certainly a hot topic. It came up in many questions at the press conference on Wednesday. One point really stuck out to me from Fed Chair Powell. He was talking about the so-called Phillips curve, unemployment, how it relates to inflation. It seemed as though he was saying we can have a tight labor market, that's fine, but maybe the labor market isn't so tight and we are not seeing extreme wage growth. Did that really resonate with you? Did something from that conversation stick out to you?
Yeah, it's interesting, Sarah. So essentially, he's making the case that the Phillips curve with respect to wages is pretty flat. And wage growth actually has been pretty good. If you look at the lower segment of the population, so let's say the bottom 40% of wages paid, they're up almost 4.5% in the last year, which is great. And even the top earners are up almost 3%. And yet unemployment's 3.5%. Inflation, we just heard, is ticked up, but it's nothing crazy. So I think Chair Powell is right when he says we can probably tolerate lower unemployment than we thought in the past without inflation going wild. So the curve is flatter, but not totally flat.
Yeah, Mike, the other big news this week, obviously, was what appears to be we're getting closer and closer to a trade deal. Now, to be honest, as we record this on a Thursday, it looks like the latest report suggests that they're very close. Who knows what will happen in the half hour that we record
people
this.
People listening to this laughing hysterically.
Yeah, right, right. Have at it. We deserve it if you
things
know, if
go
that
the
happens.
Other way.
What are yields going to look like, though, if we do reach a peace between U.S. and China in trade? Or, I mean, you know, the 10-year Treasury is now approaching that 2% level. Where do you expect it to stop if we do get good news on the trade front?
We've been making the case if there's a fairly modest trade deal, which I would call this potential thing, that the 10-year Treasury goes to 210, maybe 215. And the way we get there is we looked at where 10 stood back on July 31st. So that was the day of the first Fed ease. The 10-year was 202. The next day, you might recall, President Trump put out his tweet really mandating that all U.S. companies find alternatives to Chinese suppliers. So we think that something like 201, 202 is pretty easy to beat. But since that date, there's been so much easing by central banks, we'd say anything a lot higher than that's probably out of reach. So 210, maybe 215 if you're aggressive. Somewhere in that range we think makes sense.
Chris, I want to bring you in here on that topic. So say we do get a trade deal this weekend. All is great. All of a sudden you see yields maybe move up to 210, 215. Is that still a good environment for equities going forwards? I mean, they're still pretty low interest rates.
Right. What's not to like, really? I mean, the one thing you have to think about is that you've just had this gigantic year. And one interpretation of what happened is that what usually happens, the stock market looks ahead to the future. The market may well be saying something good about the macro backdrop in 2020. The question is, how much more do you really expect out of stocks right now? I mean, you're going to have like 25, 27% year here, expecting tons more on top. It's certainly possible, you know, growth is not supposed to fall apart, earnings supposed to be strong. But the question is, how much was that baked in 2019?
Something that someone said to me this week, and I found very interesting on the trade subject, was that even if we do get a trade deal, and sure, China goes along and buys agricultural goods, things seem like they're moving along pretty nicely. Maybe phase one turns into phase two, phase three, per se. The issue is that companies have already started changing their supply chains, and that's pretty expensive. And if they have been changing their supply chains over the past year and a half, whenever this all started back in March of 2018, wouldn't it be pretty difficult then for companies to start really going back to how it was, or not putting money into changing these supply chains again, and that profits could remain crimped from that point that could then feed into the global economy next year? Is that anything of the sort that you're thinking of with your team over at Wells Fargo?
I'd say a bit, and I certainly take the point that, yes, there's probably been some switch over to whether it's Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, who knows, but countries ex-China, but probably not anywhere near 100%. So those companies who have not made the switch, who said, gee, we hope this blows over, they should benefit quite a bit if there's some sort of deal. So I guess the way I'd frame it from a market standpoint is, would there be a decent uptick in confidence? Almost certainly. Would there be a pickup in growth? Probably. So it should be a pretty good risk-on move if this happens.
You know, Mike, we're getting near the end of the year, obviously. And
thank goodness. It's been a long one.
It has been a long year.
But there's one hurdle left to go, and that is the sort of funding stress that you often see at the end of the year in the repo market. Walk us through how you're thinking about that. And really, for the listeners who are not too in the weeds in this market, me being one of them, for example, explain to us why this funding stress happens at the end of the year and what role the repo market plays in it.
Yeah, it's been an incredibly hot topic over the last few months. Repo spiked in mid-September. The Fed got very concerned about it. But to back up a little bit, the core of the problem, we would say, and probably most people would agree, is that bank balance sheets are very constrained. Capital requirements are tight. There are all sorts of liquidity issues, et cetera, et cetera. So banks probably don't have as much flexibility to put cash into the repo market as you might think. Now, the way this showed up in September is that something called excess reserves has gone down a lot, and it's probably a misnomer. The reserves aren't really so excess. And at the margin, that one extra dollar really tipped the market into a frenzy, and all of a sudden there was simply not enough cash to go around. Now, the Fed saw this, everyone in the market saw it, and the central bank response to a problem is put lots of liquidity into the system. Now, this addresses the symptoms, but not the underlying core of the problem. The core of the problem is you need regulatory relief, but that probably takes quite a while. So the Fed is pushing a lot of liquidity into the system now. There was an announcement not too long ago that talked about doing a bit more of that. So we think the Fed is very much on the game, if you will. There are two schools of thought. We are of the mind that the Fed will put enough liquidity in the system to really mitigate big problems. Repo probably goes up somewhat toward the end of the year. It was about 5% a year ago. Right now, it's around 4 for the turn of the year. Maybe it gets back to 5, but we very much doubt it gets to 9 or 10, which is where it was in September. But talking to a lot of clients, they tell me, I get it, but you still may have a case where a number of big banks really don't want to put the cash out. So any amount of liquidity will not be enough. We think that's unlikely, but it's possible. So that's really the issue in a nutshell.
Is the supply of treasuries part of the issue, especially on that short end? I mean, here we are, we're running a $1 trillion deficit. Investors are more in the mood for risky assets, it seems like. Those primary dealers having a hard time funding purchases of treasuries. And here we have politicians talking about perhaps a middle class tax cut next year, so maybe even bigger deficits. I mean, isn't that supply of treasuries part of the story too?
It is a big part of the story. So long term, you look at the U.S. budget deficit of around $1 trillion. Treasury has to fund it. That means lots of net issuance. Now, the primary dealers have to buy. That's what it means to be a primary dealer. So if you look at primary dealer holdings of treasuries, they've roughly doubled in the last year from about $150 billion to about $300 billion. Now, this is just the primary dealer aspect of a bank. It's not the entire bank. So at some point, you can say, well, maybe the primaries have about as much as they want. They really don't want to have more treasuries on the balance sheet. Maybe the Fed could come to the rescue. This is why Chairman Powell recently got the question, I think anyway, about potentially expanding the universe of securities the Fed would buy, maybe buying some of these short coupon bonds that dealers own, that sort of thing. So yes, it's very much the case, the big deficit and heavy treasury supply impact the repo situation.
So should we just expect that Fed balance sheet to just keep growing throughout 2020 and beyond? I mean, I promise not to call it quantitative easing.
No, not QE. QE is bad. Can't call it QE.
But I mean, that balance sheet is, it's hard to imagine it shrinking again anytime soon, right?
We agree with that. And the Fed really has talked about making Fed funds the primary tool for conducting monetary policy, but QE seems awfully convenient. Do a little QE, buy some treasury bills, try to help fix the repo problem, maybe expand out the curve, possibly, if things aren't going that well. So I think you're right. You probably will see the balance sheet expand.
In a theoretical world, I'm asking this just because over the past week, I'll call it, there was some hubbub over the repo squeeze, talking about a potential year-end squeeze. Say, theoretically, we did see that happen. Could we potentially see fallout to other areas of the fixed income space as well? Or would it be more so concentrated?
You could see fallout. Repo is really like the grease that keeps the engine moving, spinning. So if that really gets clogged, it makes it much tougher for clients of any type to transact and very difficult for players like hedge funds to get short-term funding. Not to say it's completely unavailable, but available at really stratospheric rates. So there could be a lot of fallout.
Chris, I feel like the repo market is something equity investors pretend doesn't exist until they have to cram their studies about what's going on. You know, in what you edit and what you read, does this repo, all this liquidity to the repo market, I think the assumption from a lot of people is that this is part of this last leg of the rally in stocks. Is liquidity good for stocks no matter what, even if it's in the short end of the curve?
Yes, and an argument can be made that things that strain the system, like a gigantic budget deficit, is weirdly good for stocks. It's a liquidity provider. That's the reason. I mean, it's a giant tax cut basically at the back of that, and that's been arguably a huge factor in the background again for the stock market. So these things are tailwinds until they become headwinds. You never really know when a giant, it's a big nebulous issue for the market. I think people are aware that the U.S. is getting a little over its skis on some of its borrowing. And to the extent that the whole repo thing is emblematic of that. It's a factor for the market, but I would agree. Your average equity guy doesn't pretend it doesn't exist. It just doesn't want to talk about it because it's beyond his capacities.
I will say, though, in more and more conversations with different investors that I speak with, liquidity is coming up as a reason for this year-end rally in equities. I ask them what's going on. They talk about the balance sheet. They talk about this not being QE, but the fact of the matter is there's more liquidity in the system. And Ned Davis had a pretty good research note on this, and they said, look, money flows to where it's treated best. And right now, it's being treated well in the equity world.
I mean, if you buy that last year's sell-off was the opposite, it was a reaction to Powell going too far in the other direction, that you kind of have to buy that argument for this year. I mean, the Fed is sitting there, you know, ladling liquidity into stockholders' hands.
So, Mike, it all gets back to what is the biggest risk of all this, these huge deficits, this huge issuance of treasuries, the Fed buying? I mean, does it all get back to inflation? As long as inflation stays cool enough that, you know, these giant deficits, this giant supply doesn't matter?
If inflation's low and therefore borrowing costs are low, it's probably not a huge issue with respect to the U.S. budget. And it's interesting how many presidential candidates this cycle have talked about fiscal restraint. That's right. Zero. Nobody. Nada. Yeah. And President Trump also I put in that camp. So no one at the top seems super concerned about it. We can come up with risks. It's conceivable. Maybe there's a foreign buyer strike. But I think you have to ask yourself, what else would they buy? Do you really think investors in Japan or China or elsewhere in Asia or Latin America are going to buy a lot of European government bonds that have negative yields? Probably not. Do you really think that investors who actually need a lot of liquidity potentially and want high credit quality can go too far away from the U.S.? Doesn't seem that likely. So the U.S. markets, by virtue of being very homogeneous, for one, and liquid, and also having excellent credit quality, it's a home field advantage. So it's tough to lose that.
I don't know if you follow the whole craze of modern monetary theory, MMT at all, but you know, the idea that deficits don't matter. We've spent our lifetimes worrying about deficits.
Just crank up that printing press.
Right. are they sort of being proven right to some degree, do you think? At least, you know, for example, if you're the U.S. and your currency is the reserve currency, and you don't have to really worry about a major devaluation in the currency if you're cranking up the printing presses.
Recently, it's worked out. I certainly wouldn't accept that long term. But in a world where yields are generally quite low globally and the U.S. has a reserve currency, the U.S. government can run a pretty big deficit. And right now, it's the biggest by far across G10. It's more than 5% of the U.S. GDP. And the next biggest one is sort of a tie between Japan and France at about 3%. So the U.S. is running a much bigger deficit, no doubt.
Your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
So going back to the interest rate conversation, but bringing it over to equities, something that did happen this week was that the S&P 500 Financial Index, very closely tied to movements in interest rates lately, finally took out its 2007 high. So Chris, what does this really tell you about how far we've come, the journey that it's been over the past 12 years or so?
Right. It's sort of the final chapter in that, in the financial crisis from a stock market perspective. I think you have to look at it as really mainly testament to the power of the bull market. The bull market, insanely powerful thing. Pretty much everything that you could do, you could throw up in the face of to impede bank earnings has been done. All the Volcker stuff, risk-taking reined in, and interest rate environments, the opposite of what they want, pretty much. And yet, those stocks still pulled up above all that stuff. They rallied an insane amount from the bottom. They fell the most and they had to rise something like sixfold to get back to a record. So I think it's entirely the rising tide of the stock market and nothing specific to bank stocks other than the fact that they're part of the U.S. economy and are taking part and their earnings have slowly crept back.
Chris, one of the stories that caught my eye from your team this week was this notion that a lot of the strategists on Wall Street are getting bullish towards small caps. Now, is that sort of, you know, an unwind of the defensives versus cyclical trade in some degree? I mean,
That's obviously true.
You know, the S&P is a little bit more defensive than the Russell 2000. Yeah. Is that all part and parcel of that, do you think?
That makes sense. There's a bunch of different ways to frame it. One would just be, how much more bullish can they get, as we were discussing, on large caps or mega caps in the U.S.? I mean, you just had a gigantic year. You've run out of positive things. There's actually this dynamic where they actually set their 2020 estimates, and then the market went crazy underneath them. So all of those pretty optimistic estimates, when they set them now on a percentage basis, look like nothing. This is sort of this is something we've touched on a few times. So they've run out of things to be excited about. And if there's one thing that strategists are going to perennially do, it's try to be excited about something. Small caps are the one thing that's kind of outperformed this year. And, you know, it makes sense that that's what they're choosing.
I do have to say, there was one quote in that story about small caps that I was a little bit skeptical of, just because one person came out and said that, well, yeah, small caps might take off in the fact that we get a trade deal and all of a sudden they're more domestically oriented and small caps should do better. But a year and a half ago, people were saying the exact opposite, that once we got a trade war, then more domestically oriented U.S. stocks should do better. And they never did.
Yeah. Looking for a coherent, I would be against anyone like parsing the things that I say week to week on this podcast for consistency half the time. I know
Eli Panami is a
big fan.
Eli
Panami,
yeah.
He would never cast any doubt on my theses.
Mike, let's turn to Europe a little bit. Christine Lagarde made her debut at the ECB this week. Clearly, she didn't break anything. You know, no major freakouts in markets. Do you see much of a change of the guard there, or is it sort of steady as she goes in Europe?
It's a change of Lagarde, but as
far as
there you go.
Da-da-da. I walked right into that.
You did. Thank you. I thought she was very smooth.
Yeah.
She's a super seasoned politician, as we know. So as far as being able to present and get a message across, she might already be the best central banker on day one. That's quite possible, just given her personal experience. As far as policy goes, I would agree. She didn't say much, but didn't really have to. ECB is starting a review next month. That'll go on a good chunk of the year, just like the Fed is doing a review. So that gives some cover. And the ECB has already been so easy for so long, it's hard to see a radical shift getting easier, maybe a little bit on the margin. Maybe the deposit rate goes from minus 50 to minus 60, but probably the better avenue is to do a bit more QE. So we don't see a huge shift on tap right now, but at this point, we just don't know enough about her views.
You know, one story we had out after her press conference was there was a discussion beforehand about the negative effects of negative yielding debt. So they are listening to sort of the complainers out there, the pension funds, the banks, the
us.
I'm curious, you know, you've been in this business a while. Would 20 years ago, would you have ever guessed, A, we'd see negative yielding debt? And where do you see it going in 2020 or that whatever X number of trillion dollars of negative yielding debt? It's bound to come down, I would guess, right?
Negative yielding debt is not something I would have foreseen, or probably anyone really, years ago. And yet here it is, and it's huge. It's whatever the number is today, 13, 14 trillion,
some
crazy number. So we suspect when the history is written about negative policy rates, they'll be deemed to be a pretty poor idea. It doesn't seem to us they've worked a ton. Again, we prefer the QE avenue if a central bank is going for non-traditional policy. And QE has a really disruptive effect on banking systems. So it seems especially ironic in Europe, which is very banking centric, that it's gone super negative. US hasn't done that.
All right. So before we get to the craziest thing, Chris, coming back to you again, as a shameless plug, a reporter and editor on your team, Lu Wang, has a great story coming out this weekend, and it's about the best Sharpe ratio ever. So I was hoping you could maybe give us a little bit of a preview.
Well, that's a great stat. That's just looking at the basically volatility adjusted return in the S&P 500, which means, so if you're an asset and you bounce around 10% a day, and it's an incredibly jarring ride, then it's less of a big deal in a way if you cover 100, if you double, say, because, you know, the moves have been so big, you could just as easily have fallen by half or fallen by 80%. This is, the Sharpe ratio means that it's just a steady climb. It measures the steadiness and the slope of the climb. And what she found is that this year, or this decade, the one coming right after the financial crisis, the one where everyone was like, stocks are dead, you can't touch stocks, is the best decade on record, as far as we can calculate a Sharpe's ratio going back about 80 years, this is bigger than just a little bit bigger than the tech bubble. The tech bubble was interesting, much bigger return, but much more volatility on the way up. If you look at the charts of like 1999, they're crazy. The moves all look like year moves. This year, just incremental, a couple meltdowns, but for the most part during the last 10 years, pretty much steady climb without a hell of a lot of volatility.
You know what I thought, speaking of Sharpe ratios, I was curious, if you take a triple levered stock fund, what would you guess? Higher Sharpe or lower Sharpe than the regular?
By far lower.
Higher, my man.
What?
Higher.
So Mike and I were on the ETF Trillions podcast this past week,
yeah.
And Mike would not stop talking about leveraged ETFs. Yeah. He's all about it.
If you bought the triple levered QQQ, 4,000% return.
Okay, because some insane in return. Okay.
In the decade,
yeah,
the decade.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Your numerator's higher than your denominator.
All right, I guess that adds up. Kind of. I feel like it would have gone to zero a few times.
Well,
but put
his, you know, if you're bullish stocks, go big or go home. You know?
If you never get stopped out, sure.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, that's pretty crazy to kick it off.
Listeners at home, I do not really recommend that. It's just a discussion point.
We don't recommend anything.
I just wanted to get the Trillions ETF listeners riled up about something. Yeah. So maybe they'd hate listen to this show.
Sure.
All right, so I guess the Sharpe ratio for a leveraged ETF is pretty crazy. But Mike, what's your actual crazy thing this week?
Okay. You guys might have noticed President Trump was a little angry recently. Did you notice that? Yeah. What do you think he's angry about, Chris?
Oh, he doesn't like the kid who hates the climate change.
He doesn't like that kid. That's true. Mike, what do you think he's angry at?
Not thrilled about the impeachment thing.
Yeah, he's angry about that stuff, but he was really angry about toilets.
Yes.
He's mad at how often you have to flush a toilet. He came out and he said, people are flushing toilets 10, 15 times. I don't know anyone who flushes needs to flush a toilet 15 times. Granted, I do not travel in the same social circles as President Trump. But it got me, a lot of people making jokes about this. But as sort of the equities background, it made me think, well, are we going to have to replace our toilets now because of President Trump? And what stocks could benefit from that? So I did some research, some research on toilets.
I'm sure you really enjoyed that research.
A good website to start if you're curious, flushguide.com.
Oh, flushguide.com. Good to know.
A lot of this comes from them. The hottest toilet in the country, American Standard, it's not American. It's made in Japan by a company called Lixil. And actually, the second biggest toilet maker is a company called Toto, also Japanese.
That would also probably make Trump mad.
So I figured, all right, someone's got to be buying toilet stocks after this comment, right? Mm. Not really. Lixil down about 2% since Trump said this. Toto, though, up 1%. So I thought, well, what could it be about Toto? And they sell, you're not going to believe this, Sarah. This is the craziest thing I've seen in a while. Their NeoRest NX2 dual flush toilet, list price $13,000.
What?
Well, you're going to be using it.
What a market.
Right. But you got to look at it. It's a thing of beauty. It looks like Steve Jobs designed this thing and put the price on it.
You know what's crazy? I never thought that we'd be talking about toilets on this show for a couple minutes at a time.
Yeah, I can go on.
I know you can. Right. I can tell.
But Trump would love this one because it has technology known as the tornado flush.
Mm-hmm.
Two powerful nozzles that create centrifugal cyclonic rinsing action. Is more effective in one flush than most toilets are with multiple flush. Trump, if you're listening, I got the solution here.
Fixed.
Amazing. Unbelievable. Chris, did you come prepared with anything?
Well, I was just going to bring up the crazy Walmart cocaine Santa, and that's it. Moving on.
Wait, you need to explain the cocaine Santa.
It's a sweater or a placemat or something that depicts snowman Santa sitting in front of snow with the crazy eyes, and the snow is arranged in little white lines. And I don't think it's called cocaine Santa, but then the caption is, oh, it's going to be a white Christmas. So this thing lasted like 20 minutes before they were forced to pull it because of popular outcry, possibly.
Right. Off of
probably,
Walmart's site.
Yes, right. Possibly appropriate.
The ugly sweaters are a big thing around the holidays now. I think that's catering to that.
Yeah.
Big stimulus to the economy. Mm. All right, Sarah, what do you got?
So did everyone here see the original video of the Tesla Cybertruck when they were going to throw
window.
The ball at it, smash the window, huge mistake. So there's another video that's now making its ways around with the Tesla Cybertruck. And it's Elon Musk himself decided he was going to take out one of the prototypes to go eat at Nobu in Malibu, California. And there's a video of him on TMZ. He's leaving in the Cybertruck, and at the very end of it, he knocks over a sign, makes an illegal turn the wrong way. So once again, a video of the Tesla Cybertruck making its way around the internet. But at the same time, Tesla stock is trading at the highest levels in a year. So maybe all the publicity is good.
I'm a contrarian on that Cybertruck. I think it's going to sell well.
Yeah?
I do.
It looks like something you'd find on the moon.
It looks amazing. It really does. Yeah.
All right. Mike, did they warn you about our gimmick here, the craziest thing?
I was thinking about this, and it's very difficult to top the funky Santa, the toilets, or the truck, but
we come prepared.
I will throw out that I think our president tweeted something like 100 times this past Sunday. It was some crazy number.
What?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So 100 times on Sunday?
I'll put that out. Just think about the interval between tweets, what fraction of his waking time was tweeting. It's pretty high.
Is that all original tweets? Does that include retweets?
Well, now you're getting pretty deep. I don't know that.
It's the important information that we need to know.
Sorry, you got to tweet more.
I do. I can't even match 100. I could maybe tweet 100 times in 2 years, maybe. I've got to step it up.
Work to do,
We've all got work to do.
Well, one guy who tweets a lot is Eli Paname, who can't get enough of the Magi.
I actually know who this person is, and he's gotten about 2,000% more airtime than he deserves. I'm sure he's going crazy.
Well,
right now.
He got exactly what he wants. Okay. So with that said, Chris Nagy, Mike Schumacher, thank you so much for both coming on the show.
Thanks. Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. Chris Nagy is at ChrisNagy1. And you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.